Ranger, nurse, detective, hiker, author. Am I missing anything, Andrea?
Outdoor adventurer.
You do have some amazing records that I hope we can get to, because obviously I read stuff about you on the internet, and everything on the internet is true, obviously, but you did some incredible feats. I'm blown away by them.
Yeah, I me too. I was a lot younger then.
I appreciate you doing this podcast, and thank you for sending me an early copy of your book. Congratulations on it, Trail of the Lost, The Relentless Search to Bring Home the Missing Hikers of the Pacific Crest Trail. Have you ever seen anyone reading any of your books in public yet?
No, I haven't. That's a good question.
Would
Dang,
you would you approach them?
No, I think I would give them space.
Really?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe if I was on a plane and I already had a gin and tonic or two, I probably would.
When did you know Ranger Confidential was a hit? Like, when did you know you had something for that book? Because you've authored a few books. That one really hit. When did you know, like, okay, I got something here?
Well, people say that, but it was a more of a slow process. I had trouble selling it to an agent and then to a publisher. I just knew there was an audience for it while I was writing it because I knew there's people interested in knowing the real story behind the scenery and what it was like to be a park ranger. So there wasn't, I think I know more now because I hear that the sales numbers are good for that book. So it took a while for me to know that.
Were you checking reviews a lot as like a first-time author, second-time author? Do you check the reviews a lot?
I do look at reviews. I think, some authors it might be too hard for them, but for me, a good critical review will help me be a better writer. If they say, hey, it jumped around too much, for example. So that'll push me to get better at my transitions. So I do look at some critical reviews, but if this is kind of they're just being nasty, I don't
Yeah.
pay that much attention to it.
You got to fill in the blanks for me. You graduated school in Tennessee. Where did it go from you want to be the Ranger Academy, pursue that line of work, Ranger, law enforcement? Where was the fill in the blanks for me there?
Yeah, well, I never saw myself going into law enforcement. I was
Okay.
outdoorsy. I wanted to work with animals and work outdoors, and I have a degree in forestry. A bachelor of science degree. But back then in the early 80s, it wasn't easy to get a job. And so I was still bagging groceries at Kroger's. And my boyfriend said, hey, why don't you go to this Ranger Academy with me and we'll learn how to handcuff people and pursuit driving? And I said, okay, I didn't have anything better to do. And once I went to the Ranger Academy, I was hired a job at seasonal work at Cape Hatteras pretty soon after.
And how was it as a, like you said, in the 80s, female rookie ranger, was it difficult?
Well, I would say yes and no. It was challenging, at first. And I'd never been exposed to law enforcement. Nobody in my family does law enforcement, and so it was a little nerve-wracking at first. And I'm the type of person that really wants to do a good job. But I really got hooked because I started protecting the nest of baby sea turtles. And for me, because I love animals, and they are endangered and threatened. That raised the stakes for me. I knew this was a job that needed to be done, and it needed to be done by people who, gave a you know what. And so then I was motivated, and I loved it. And so I loved being a law enforcement park ranger, at least at first.
Yes, because you guys and gals, you wear so many hats. You're doing permits, you're doing trails, search and rescue, guns. You just mentioned animals, patrolling campgrounds. At first, it's like, that's awesome, but you guys are completely overworked, right?
Yes, understaffed and overworked, wearing too many hats. I think one thing you missed in there was medical response. EMTs. I was a park medic, which is almost like a paramedic, and search and rescue. Of course, all these jobs are dangerous, and you're doing all of them, sometimes all at the same scene. And there was a while there where the statistics were that a park ranger was 12 times more likely to get killed on the job than was a special agent with the FBI.
That's craziness. When I was a rookie in Times Square, I remember the first week, I'm like, this is amazing. I'm in like the crossroads of the world, the glitz, the glamour, the lights. And then after a week, I'm like, this is my job, whatever. Was that the same for you? Because you were at Yosemite and the Grand Canyon, like, look at your backdrop. Did it get old after a while? Or was it like, okay, I'm going to work here?
The backdrop never got old, but the disillusionment like you, because it starts getting tainted, you know, like your family comes to visit you and they're oohing and aahing, and you go, well, that's where I did a body recovery, and that's where they were sexually abusing, you know, the child in the campground. It changes how you look at it for sure. It doesn't take too long for that to happen.
Because you worked at a few different parks. Do you guys request transfers or is it needs of the department? Because you were like in cool places and they're far away from each other.
You request transfers, and usually to get promoted, you have to move, which is a tough part of the job. You know, you can't just get a job in New York and stay in New York. You know, if you want to promote, maybe you have to move your entire family across country, and live in the middle of nowhere to take a good job, to get promotions. But it also allows you to work in a lot of different environments, which I got to do, and that part was great. I loved working it. I worked at Cape Hatteras, Zion National Park, Yosemite, and the Grand Canyon.
That's awesome. When did you get tired of not the bad stuff you saw, because you saw death and tragedy, but the behind the scenes stuff that really led to you leaving the Rangers early?
That started before I became a permanent full-time, because I
Oh,
was a
wow.
seasonal for 4 years and no health insurance, no job security, no pension. And that you know, I started to get concerned, you know, is this going to be steady enough for me? Am I going to be able to make enough money to live? And I started looking at law enforcement agencies, actually. But a good superior found a way to make me permanent full time, and that kind of set me back into loving the job again. Then later, I'm sure, as you know, and your colleagues know, the politics and the office games and that stuff got old, and also being so overworked, working so much overtime, being sleep deprived, things like that got the best of me.
Like you said, you were doing search and rescue. Then one day you're doing, I saw on your Instagram, a gun arrest and a drug arrest. So you're doing so much. And like you said, so short-staffed. It must just be wearing everybody, right? Is morale low there?
They say it's still low, that the Rangers are still overworked, still feel unappreciated. And in fact, the visitation's gone way up. We thought it was super busy when I was working in the 90s, and the visitation's gone up even more, but the staffing, especially in law enforcement, has gone down. So I feel for the ones that are out there now doing what I used to do decades ago.
I want to talk more about your personal life, but I want to talk since we're pretty much best friends now. I got the book Trail of the Lost, The Relentless Search to Bring Home the Missing Hikers of the Pacific Crest Trail. Comes out August 22nd. Do you enjoy the process of writing a book? Because it's years of your life engrossed into one subject. Do you enjoy that?
Yes and no. There's times I love it, trying to bring true stories to life in a way that's easy to read and educates people and also gives them feelings. I love that. But the trying to sell it, you know, and pitch it and get an agent and get a publisher, that part I'm not that fond of.
I love having authors on, and I'm always like, when you hit send for the final draft, do you have like a ritual? And this is like your fourth or fifth book now. So when you hit send, there's no more edits, it's ready to roll. Do you have like a ritual, something you do?
No, I should go, you know, drink a bottle of champagne, but then I'm just so relieved. I guess I go for a walk just to burn off all that steam.
I'm a huge reader. I love doing it. And there are a few books that really like talk to me to the sense where I need to know what happens next. And while I was reading this book, it almost ruined my 4th of July weekend because I'm telling my family, I'm like, it's such a weird story. I'm telling them about the hikers, which we're going to talk about. And I needed to get home. So I wanted to leave 4th of July parties early just to come finish a book. That's how I knew this book was like, I was telling my wife, I'm like, this book is awesome. She's like, tell me about it. And I'm telling her, and she's like, I'm like, no, don't look it up. Don't go on YouTube. You have to read this book because you do such a deep dive into it. I loved it so much.
Yeah, I did, and I wanted it to read like how it felt, because it felt like that, like what's going to happen next. And you know, as we get more in the story and working with this eclectic team of people, and we're just constantly texting each other with a new lead or just some new crazy thing that happened on the trail, and so it felt like the way it reads.
I'm glad you mentioned emotional because you wrote this book, and I want to ask you if there's any people like maybe true crime authors that you followed because you wrote the book and you were a part of the book, a very big part of the book, And yet you made sure your emotions were in there. So as a reader, I'm like, oh my God, she's invested. I'm emotionally invested. So I couldn't even imagine what you guys did. Are there any authors you kind of model yourself after?
You know, I love literary true crime, and I've, you know, going all the way back to Truman Capote in Cold Blood. I actually think if he wrote that book now, he would put himself in the story. And because also that is what the editors and agents want. They're often pushing me to put myself more in the story because I tend to be more fascinated with other people. And as you see, when you read my books, they have other characters that I'm writing about and I get in their heads and try to tell what it's like for them. So I'm often pushed to put me more in the story, but if I'm going to be in the story, it is also about feelings. It's just not about the facts. It's how this stuff affects us, how we cope with tragedy and failure and even success and what that means on an emotional level as well as a factual one.
Yeah, emotion was a great thing because it's an emotional roller coaster, what you guys, and we're going to talk about in a second, what you guys go through. It, you get a lead and you're excited, then it doesn't happen. And then you get down and depressed. That must be just, you know, just so heavy on you guys to do, isn't it?
It was. It was really hard. Now, for us that are trying to help the families of the missing, though, it's the hardest for them. You know, I write about, they call it a hope hangover because these people so badly want answers. You know, what happened to my loved one? Are they alive or are they dead? And they get real invested in a lead. And then if the lead ends up being bogus or you follow it to the end, you know, their hopes go up and then they crash and burn. So I had to watch these families go through this several times. So of course we felt so bad for them. And there are times we were wondering, are we helping or not by helping them follow these leads? It's a very tough situation to be in, to have a loved one who is missing.
And the one other thing was like, you would give them hope, not you guys give them hope, a lead would come in on Facebook or something and you'd get excited. And then when nothing happened, now it's just a lull. Now you wait for the next possible lead. And I'm like, oh my God, I was getting like so hurt. I'm like, oh my, and I have no connection. I'm like, oh my God, what these mothers and these parents, oh my, it's a difficult read. Would you classify this as a true crime book?
It is to me. You know, other people may not see it that way, but you know, true crime is about what law enforcement does as part of true crime. And law enforcement has to investigate missing person cases. And if you're a park ranger, you often have to investigate missing hiker cases. Until you find a body, foul play is always a specter out there. Were they a victim of foul play? One thing I like to say about a missing hiker case for the investigator is you have a lot of suspects and not all of them are human.
I cannot wait to get to that. This is why this book can be a movie. So we will not play spoiler alert. How about we talk about each hiker and kind of their the circumstances why they went missing? Is that cool?
Yes.
Okay. So Chris, you want to start it off with Chris Sylvia?
Yeah. Chris Sylvia was the case that got me involved. He was 28 years old, originally from Maryland, back more close to your neck of the woods. And he had recently moved to California and he was going through some personal problems. He didn't have a job and his roommate talked him into hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And this was February 2015. And about 4 days into his hike, he called to be taken off by his friend, but his friend came out to pick him up and Chris isn't there. Later, hikers found his gear on the trail and that's where I came in 2 years later to investigate the case. There was a big search for him, 50 searchers, dogs, aircraft, everything, but he was never been found.
You were emotionally invested into that case because it was one of your older cases, hit home, didn't it?
Yes. In 1995, I worked as search operation chief for a case of a 20-year-old missing young man. Also was out of work, living in a friend's apartment, and he disappeared in the Grand Canyon, and I failed to find him. And that haunted me for decades. And so when I saw Chris Sylvia's case, it reminded me so much of that earlier case. I think that played a big role in me calling Chris Sylvia's family and asking for their blessing to do a pro bono investigation into Sylvia's disappearance.
So you're into this case. And this one for me is like one of the most frustrating ones because he told his friend, hey, pick me up at this location. He's not there. And listen, everyone goes to pick up a friend. If they're not there, you get pissed off. Like, F this, I'm out, and you leave. And then he's missing. And then they find his stuff laid out. this one left so many questions. As we're doing this, I'm making little notes. I'm like, okay, obviously he did this. And like, there's so many different possibilities. Where he left off, I know there was helicopters and dogs. Wasn't it very like a flat area that he should have been found if he was there? Like it wasn't a lot of hills, or is that, am I wrong?
It was an arid ridge with low-level brush. So if he just kind of got to a high spot, you could see where roads were and trails are at. And there's even a hostel there that I write about, Mike's Place, which has kind of a interesting background. And so it's not a place where an adult's going to get lost. You'd be able to see your landmarks and get found. And the fact that his gear was found on the PCT, the Pacific Crest Trail, made me feel I could solve this case. I always came in it kind of confident, like,
I'm gonna bang this out
they missed
quick.
something. Yeah. I learned the hard way that that wasn't the case. That case is frustrating. And they all are, but this one has a lot of different possibilities. And one of the possibilities was that maybe he was still alive and he voluntarily disappeared. And in the book, we don't want to spoil it
No.
too much. There are some things that happen that lead you to think that that is definitely a possibility with the Chris Sylvia case.
And then you fast forward a little bit, and it's Sherpa, Chris Fowler. His mom, like, I was getting so emotional into this one. He was a very experienced hiker, and he was so close to finishing. What, it's over 2,600 miles.
Yes, he had gone all the way from Mexico. He's all getting close to the Canadian border, and he has a little bit of what they call border fever. You've come that far, and by God, I'm gonna make it. And there was a storm coming, and Chris Sherpa Fowler, he was 34, very experienced, just a real likable, attractive guy, and he went missing in October of 2016. His mother is a major character in the story, Sally Fowler, and her father was a law enforcement officer, and although that's not her line of work, you could tell that that investigative gene had passed on to Sally. And so she did an excellent investigation of her own into her son's disappearance. And I share her story in Trail of the Lost.
His story is frustrating because there were possible lies about sightings with him and people who were adamant about sightings, and all the sightings couldn't line up time-wise. So it was like, if this person's telling the truth, then he was here, the bartender. There was a lot of sightings, and that is the whole roller coaster you're talking about, correct?
Yeah, I bet you and your colleagues experienced this. Eyewitnesses statements, they're such a funny thing. And they go from, you know what, they're making this up to get attention to, whoa, I cannot let this sighting go. Maybe that was him. And if that was him, WTF, right? Where the heck is he? So these sightings are very challenging to deal with.
And they're so far apart, some of the sightings. So it's not like, hey, we saw him in Brooklyn. Let's focus on Brooklyn. These are maybe sometimes they're states apart, correct?
Yes, maybe even countries apart, so sometimes it's the sightings in Canada or something. But with Chris Fowler, yeah, hundreds of mile apart with varying, like if he's seen on the trail, has different implications than if someone saw him in a bar somewhere or getting on a bus somewhere. And so your search area is so complicated and huge. It's extremely challenging for a search investigator to try to decide where exactly to search for someone like Chris Fowler.
And then there's David O'Sullivan, who came from Ireland, who wasn't the most experienced hiker, but like you had to love him because he read the book Wild. I bet you probably hate this book Wild because there's so many people that have to go do their thing. But he did like so much research on it, and then he emailed his mom from the library, walks across a trail, and that's it. He's never seen from again.
Yeah, David O'Sullivan's 25 from Ireland, like really a cool dude, a disciplined dude. He had a black belt in karate, but he was new at hiking and backpacking. And he was reading a book After Dark that has a characters that disappear. It's a novel, fiction, that characters that disappear in the book. And sure enough, he ends up vanishing there in Southern California near the San Jacinto Mountains. And there are lots of sightings of him too that really confuse the investigation. He's also an area where there are marijuana grows and mountain lions, but also icy slopes. There's also a cult in the area near where both David O'Sullivan and Chris Sylvia disappeared. And I go into all these theories in the book.
When you're doing the Chris, you know, you're doing everything with Chris, when did you think, okay, I'm going to help out all three parties, we're going to put these together, and I want to start documenting this? Not initially, obviously not. When did you know, like, I'm going to do a book on these three?
What really jumped me into that is the Facebook missing hiker groups. They're a whole strange phenomenon. You know, mm-hmm. It's like the Wild Wild West. You know, you got catfishers, wannabes, woman-splainers, mansplainers, you know, and then every once in a while, in this Wild Wild West saloon on Facebook, a quiet hero walks in who has pure intentions and keen instincts. And one of these people was a woman I met named Kathy Tarr. She's an amateur. She has no experience in search and rescue or law enforcement, but she had taken it upon herself to help these families find Chris Fowler and David O'Sullivan. So I met with her, and once I heard her story, I went, whoa, this is a book. About this whole phenomenon of amateurs filling in a hole. Because once the officials drop the case, you don't even know if they're responding to leads or not. So these amateurs, I'll call them, a lot of them come with good skills, but they come in to help the family. And I just thought it was amazing how dedicated they were. And then she introduced me to Sally Fowler, and I just started to document and take recorded interviews of their experiences from there.
You're law enforcement, and the web sleuths, the amateur armchair detectives, they get a bad rap. And I don't even want to call any of these people armchair detectives because they were out there doing all the grunt work. When you joined them, did you have some apprehension? Like, okay, I'm dealing with these people who are amateurs. They're not really sure what they're doing. Obviously, that changed quickly. Did you ever have any hesitancy about doing it with them?
I didn't, because okay. I think a couple of reasons. One is I trusted my instincts. I really felt that Kathy Tarr was an honorable person. And then I started working with someone named Morgan Clements, who is a he maps terrorist activity, and sometimes he's contracted by the government to do this. And then Sally Fowler, who was, you know, very motivated to search for her son. And I had worked with volunteers before, and I write about this in Ranger Confidential, where I learned that using volunteers to help give out information on the trail can save lives, you know, on a dangerous trail like Grand Canyon. So I think I came into it with a positive feeling about amateur detectives, we'll call them that. I can be jaded. I can be a little bit jaded about the authorities sometimes, Mike.
How contagious is their energy, like the volunteers and, you know, we're going to call them amateur detectives, even though they're better than most detectives I know, the work they did. How contagious is their energy? Like, hey, we're going to go out there. We're doing this. We're going to hike in the snow, in the rain. We're not stopping. Like, I was like, I want to go help. They really pump you up, right?
Yes, they do. They do come into it. Like I said, I'm jaded. They come into it with a little more idealism than me. And that can be fueling, though. That can fuel the crushed idealists, like somebody like me. And I'm like, they're gung ho. And that does give me a little energy to help and participate with them.
Being on both sides now, what do you think the disconnect is with the amateur detectives and law enforcement? The goal should always be the same. Let's find, in this case, the missing hikers. Why is there disconnect? Why does there seem to be dissension?
I think it's a trust issue. I think law enforcement understandably has needs to keep certain aspects of their investigation protected. There's also a safety concern. You know, understandably, law enforcement is worried about the safety of these volunteer searchers going out there. But I think going forward, there's just enough evidence that these civilians can help an investigation that I feel, my opinion, is that law enforcement should learn how to work with non-government entities, to be open to working with non-government entities, to collaborate in solving cases.
Especially like this hiker case, I know nothing about it. I've hiked only on vacation, like I emailed you, like Machu Picchu, like, you know, the tourist hiking, okay? law enforcement in that area probably don't have to know about the underbelly of hiking. So why not bringing people who are experienced with it, who know what the hell they're talking about? Don't you agree?
Yeah, 100%. For example, you know, I talk about in the book the items that were found with Chris Sylvia's backpack. Law enforcement should have talked to an expert hiker to help them interpret what that means, what, you know, what was found and what that might mean. And just like you might hire an FBI forensic expert for something, well, if it involves hiking, maybe you should find a hiker that you trust to help you with your investigation. Because we, you know, if you're not a hiker, you don't know how, what this stuff means.
They were all around a year apart, all male, all white dudes. Any other patterns with them that you noticed?
They were all unmarried. They were all, you know, I reveal in the book, they were all carrying a book that had themes of disappearing. They were all fit and healthy, but so they did have some similarities. Yeah.
What hurdles did you guys face? Jurisdiction is a huge one, correct? With the missing thing. I'm not taking the report. It's on this one. Is that a big thing, the jurisdiction? Because you don't know exactly where they went missing.
Yeah, it's huge, especially on the Pacific Crest Trail, you know, because it's not like if you go missing Grand Canyon National Park, you know, the rangers are going to do it. It's cut and dry. On the Pacific Crest Trail, you have three states. I don't know how many counties, could be 20, you know, more counties and three countries. You have Mexico and Canada are part of it. So there's a lot of jurisdictions there. You also have federal jurisdictions with national parks and the United States Forest Service. And then you have county jurisdictions. So it does create an environment where it's kind of easy to kind of take the case as a hot potato. Yes. Well, he didn't go missing in my place. Well, he went missing in your county. No, he didn't go missing in my county. And that happened with David Sullivan's case and also with Chris Fowler's case. It's very frustrating for the family members because they're trying to get at least one officer to take this case serious and file a report.
I'm glad you said serious because you expressed frustration with various law enforcement agencies. Do they not take missing hiking cases serious, or does it happen a lot? Like, oh, this one's missing. Oh, don't worry about it. He'll show up. Because it seemed like sometimes they didn't really take it that serious.
Yeah, sometimes they don't, and it's disturbing. There's several cases that I talk about in the book, but other times they do. Sometimes it's just that initial response. With Chris Fowler's case, once Sally convinced Yakima County officer Sergeant Briscoe to take the case, I mean, they went all out. They up there in Washington, it was one of the biggest, it might still be one of the biggest searches for a missing hiker they've ever done. So it depends, but a lot of leads are dropped. And, you know, there, I don't want to spoil it too much, but there was one lead, an item that I found that was missed by those 50 searchers down there in Southern California. And they were right next to it. You know, they were within yards of it for sure. And they missed this very important clue. So things are missed. I mean, I'm sure I missed something too on some of the searches I worked. It's very challenging to work these cases.
Another hurdle that was good and bad. The good was the Brazilian man. We'll leave it at that. The bad can be social media. The Facebook groups, you go down the deep dive on Reddit. Everyone's an expert. Everyone can solve the case watching a 6-minute YouTube video. Okay, by the way, this is what happened. Suicide, kidnapping, started alone. How social media? The good and the bad, right?
Yeah, the good, the bad, and the ugly, yeah. Mike. Because to some of it is just crazy, you know, and then there's the hecklers, you know, Sally Fowler got heckled, you know, poor David O'Sullivan's mother, Carmel, she was crying in her kitchen because there's Facebook hecklers. No matter what she did, it was wrong. If she was really aggressive and trying to track down David, they said she was an overbearing mother. If she pulled back and waited to see if, you know, he would contact them, she wasn't working hard enough to find her son. So these Facebook hecklers and people trying to take it, man, they're trying to hijack a tragedy for their own agenda is what they're doing. And they are out there. But in my book, we're going to talk about some really solid heroes like Kathy Tarr, Morgan Clements, who jump in there and truly try to help these families.
Yeah, you guys were a group of heroes that just found each other. And you guys all probably go in there with a different theory. Like, hey, I think this happened to Sherpa, this happened to, you know, Chris, this one happened to David. Is it difficult to either try to convince each other, like, hey, no, I'm pretty sure this is what happened? Because you guys know your stuff. And there might be five or six of you guys in a room, in a war room with different theories. Is it hard to like even try to be like, okay, I guess you might be right on that? Or is there a lot of disagreement in there?
With theories, there's enough respect between the individuals that we sort of, well, okay, you know. So I think it was more of a collaborative environment. Now, where there were some arguments, there is a technique using drones where the drone does a grid search, and it takes it's you can't just send any drone guy to do this. It's a very involved technique, and the drone takes picture, you know, does a lawnmower grid and takes pictures at their computer screen so much, searching those images for clues. Now, sometimes somebody would find what looked to me like a rock with the shade, and they would insist it was a tent. And then the group would get in and argue a little bit about, you know, is this a rock or a tent? So that did sometimes cause some heated discussions. But in the end, we all worked together. And, you know, I don't want to spoil things too much, but that technique, some very interesting and positive outcomes came from that technique.
I don't want to play spoiled, but I'm gonna be a little fanboy here now and ask you one question that is kind of always on Reddit, always on the other sites. Do you think Chris's gear was staged?
People say that, no, it depends on what you mean by staged. I think it was laid out with intent of some kind, is how I would word that. And so staged to me would mean somebody other than Chris Sylvia laid it out. And this is a spoiler, so people want to skip over. Because I found another item of his, a book in another location nearby. I'm curious what you think, Mike. That makes me think Chris was the one that laid out the gear and he was leaving things in different locations. But honestly, I'm really curious to see what other people think, including you.
So, okay, we'll do it like that without playing spoiler because the Chris one, I went back and forth. At first, it was suicide originally. But then the more I thought of it and I tried to like really think, okay, you're going to call your friend down. And I'm like, oh, maybe he called his friend down to unfortunately find his body. Like, hey, I'm going to be at this location. Here's my body. There was no body. There was no note. It just seemed like a weird way to do it. And laying out the stuff, if he would have laid out his own stuff and wouldn't he have left a note there or something? That's what always confused me. I'm like, I feel like he went on his own. That's how I feel. And I hate that answer because it's very New York centric. Like, how do you not find someone? It's impossible to go missing. You know, I'm so New York centric. But when the clues with that one was weird. Like, why didn't he leave a note? If he wanted his friend to find him, he would have been found in that area. So where would he have gone? So the Chris one, I kind of think he might have did that on his own.
I think it's a possibility. Like I said, another spoiler is he had disappeared before for a while, or at least was reported missing before in Costa Rica, and for 3 weeks or more. So this was someone who was willing to go off grid and live off the land. He hated computers, he hated smartphones. And then you talked about the man in Brazil. There's a case that's going to be in the book where a mentally ill individual was able to get all the way from Canada to Brazil without any money or any passport. So if that guy could do it, maybe Chris Sylvia could do it.
The Sherpa one, originally, I'm like, okay, this guy, we all push our bodies through crazy things, marathons, and you would all the things you did. When you're so close to the end, I'm like, I don't care if it's going to rain. I don't care if it's 110 degrees. I'm going running. I'm doing this. So I get like, you see the finish line, you're going to go. Then I'm like, okay, but there was a storm coming. But then the sightings, the one bartender, and then the bear hunter. I'm like, oh, like they really, and that's why I was like, oh my God, you picked like the most perfect book, which is a weird way to say it because the sightings bothered me the most on that one. At first, I'm like, okay, it's the storm. He didn't stop. He had to keep going. He's a monster. He's going to finish that finish line. And then the sightings, and people are like, no, I'm adamant, and I'm not trying to be a social media star. I'm telling you, I know it was him. Isn't that one was weird too, right?
Yeah, Mike, it validates me to hear you say that because I have a very similar response. At first, I'm like, yeah, the storm got him. I'm a park ranger. I've seen it, you know, dozens of times. But those sightings, that one, the bartender sighting, which you'll read more about in the book, it is haunting. She's extremely credible. And if he was there, like I said, he could be anywhere and anything could have happened to him. And So yeah, the Chris Fowler case is unsettling. And of course, that's very hard on his mother, Sally Fowler. And then the David O'Sullivan case, you know, there are also some haunting sightings with his, but with him, it does seem more like probably that was a weather, you know, he ran into some bad weather. He was getting ready to hike into extremely treacherous, notoriously killer mountain, the San Jacinto Mountains. So that's the David O'Sullivan case.
The one question I have with the David O'Sullivan is his two friends allegedly called the park rangers and they're like, "We're not a babysitting company." That always like left me a little weird. Like, does that really happen? Like, I can't picture someone calling the NYPD and being like, "We're not a babysitter because we have to take every report for everything." Does that really happen out there?
Well, that was the Pacific Crest Trail Association. They're not a law enforcement agency. They're a
Oh, okay.
nonprofit. Yeah. And at least that is the memory of Carmela Sullivan, that she had called them for help. And, you know, they don't know how to handle a missing person case. You know, they should have told her, call the county, you know, call this county. They should have helped her that way. But I think also what happens is these, so let's see, there's, you know, hundreds a week of people being overdue hiker. And 97% of them or more are solved within 24 hours. And most of them, the person's fine. They're found alive. And sometimes it's even a miscommunication problem. And so that's what agencies are used to. You know, this is, they're going to be found here in an hour, you know, so I'm not going to get all involved. But you have to treat every missing hiker, overdue hiker as an emergency. That's how park rangers are trained, to treat it as an emergency because possibly that person, you know, has a broken leg or a head injury and they need help now. But there is a tendency to kind of, well, let's see if this solves itself, resolves itself on its own.
Writing this book, obviously these hikers are still missing. Was it difficult for you to like, it's an unsolved mystery. Is it difficult for you to be like, okay, I'm ready, or should I wait another week, another month? Maybe we'll find one. Is that like, did you fight yourself with that, wrestle yourself with that one?
Yeah, still to today, I have got to a point where if I've worked hard enough on a case, I can wait until there's another lead. You know, I could feel like I've exhausted what I could do, or I could even suggest someone else do. And so it's just a matter of waiting for another lead. Often these cases are solved by accident. Somebody just stumbles upon a mushroom hunter or a deer hunter stumbles upon some remains, and then the case is closed. But that doesn't mean it's easy. That doesn't mean you're not still thinking about it, you know, all the time.
Was it difficult to write a book about you and the group of detectives and the three missing hikers? Like you had four parts that you had to like, you kind of did equally, 25% each. Was it hard to juggle all that? I was like, as I'm reading this, I'm like, oh my God, people aren't going to realize how much work went into this book that you're focusing on the detectives, all, you guys and gals searching for them. And then about Chris and Sherpa and David, like I want to give all of them equal timing. Was that hard to juggle all that together?
Yeah, you're a very astute reader because yes, it's extremely difficult, but I still wanted to do it. I wanted to involve all the cases. I wanted to talk about a lot of these issues. I wanted to explore emotional impacts. So yeah, weaving all that together wasn't easy. I got to hand it a little bit to my editor, Carrie over at Hachette. She helped me make some really good transitions to ease the reader's experience through all that. But it's a bear of a book, no doubt.
When there's been 16, I believe you said, missing hikers on the PCT, correct? And they've all been found, or like 16, the one who's passed away, correct? And everyone has been found
Yes.
except these three, right?
Yeah, there's 16 deaths on the Pacific Crest Trail that are I wouldn't say natural, accidental deaths. There is one murder on the on the Pacific Crest Trail in 1989, and it's still unsolved. But he was not a thru hiker; he was a trail runner. And the theory is that he had come upon some people breaking into his car at the trailhead and had got in some sort of altercation with them, and they had beaten him to death. Sad case. Andy Elam was his name. He's only 19 years old. That unsolved murder on the Pacific Crest Trail is not one that people know about. You won't read much about it online.
You were in talks and helped out on a show about missing hikers. You were about to do a show, and then I guess it faded out. With this book coming out, do you think that's going to be renewed interest, or are you going to have something going where you're going to do another show about hopefully missing hikers?
Well, I can say that there is definitely interest. I could say that. Yeah, so maybe.
How can the reader or listener help? I know there's the fantastic Fowler O'Sullivan Foundation. Is that the best way to help out? Like with anything with this, with the missing hikers?
Yeah, especially on the West Coast. So the Fowler O'Sullivan Foundation, you know, you can donate, you can volunteer. There are also organizations, you know, in Texas, other, you know, you can donate to your local SAR team. You can also join, if you see a missing persons Facebook group in your community, you can join that and help spread awareness of the case to help bring in leads. You know, there the drone operations could really use some donations to help pay for equipment. So there's a lot of way to help. So one way I'd start is go to the Fowler Sullivan Foundation.
What needs to be done to improve search conditions or the search and rescue for hikers from law enforcement's aspect and park rangers? What do they need to do better?
They do need to make sure that whoever's responsible to initiating or managing a search for an agency has attended courses like managing the search function. So they understand there's a whole esoteric protocol and strategy in how you manage a search, and investigators play a role and managers and planners play a role. So they should be trained in that. So that's number one. Two, I do think when someone is reported missing, of course it might be resolved right away, but take it seriously. Help the family find out where if it's not your jurisdiction, help the family get to whose jurisdiction it is. I mean, hello, right? You know, don't just blow it off. One trend we see, it seems like when it's a young male that goes missing, the law enforcement officer tends to think he's missing on purpose. Even if the family is telling him, no, he would never do this. So watch out for your biases. I also think involving the family safely and within reason is therapeutic for them, because they feel out of control. This, and it's very tragic. And so just involving them a little bit helps give them some agency over this horrible thing that's happening to them.
I'm completely guessing this. Do less people go missing now because of GPS, smartphones, and stuff like that? Or am I completely off base?
Now, in general, missing, I couldn't answer that question for you.
But no, I mean on the hiking trails.
Yeah, missing hikers. Interestingly enough, we don't know for sure because no one is doing a good job of tracking the statistics, especially the federal government. So we don't know.
Yeah.
But anecdotally, I worried that maybe more people are going missing because there's more people out there doing this activity, and they're maybe overly relying on their cell phone. Now, if they start, you know, there's going to Apple now, the new phone, I think has a GPS locator on it. And then there are the emergency GPS locator devices that you can purchase. They're pretty expensive. Hopefully that as soon as more people have these things, will be more cases will be solved. At least we still may have people going out there and getting in trouble and dying and getting hurt, but more of these cases will be solved.
Writing this book, what was the one thing? Was it the cult? Was it Mike split the hostel? What thing surprised you the most that you had no idea was going on these trails?
You know, I think it was the cult, because I'm like, really? You know, because, you know, people say, oh, yeah, maybe you joined a cult, you know, and you're laughing about it. Yeah, sure. Okay, whatever.
You completely write it off. Like, I'm sure they joined. And then you read like, oh, well, God, the Delhi.
Yeah. And then when I learned about the cult, I even called experts and tried to see if they, you know, I was hoping, yeah, no, he didn't do it. You know, but they said, no, this is a possibility. So, yeah, the cult called the 12 tribes, and you learn a lot more about them in Trail of the Lost. And their recruitment pool is hikers. So they're looking for hikers to bring into the cult. But so, yeah, that was the most surprising one for sure.
Do you hate the movie and the book Wild because of all people who go there because of this?
You know, I don't. I read Wild. I love Wild. But the reality is it did affect through hiker culture. It attracted a different type of hiker. Like one quote I have in the book from another veteran thru hiker, he said, it used to be only hikers on the trail. Now it's all of humanity.
Yeah.
And so some people, I'm not irked by it, mm-hmm. because also I think Instagram and Facebook are equally guilty or culpable of bringing people to the trail that maybe aren't prepared as well as they should be. But no, I don't. I like wild. I'm a fan.
You pushed your body. You hiked over 2,000 miles on the trail. I'm reading now, cycled from Fairbanks to the Arctic Ocean. First female to bike the 800-mile Arizona Trail. Where does this come from to push your body to these extremes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a young person's disease. And I just, you know, as a ranger, I had a lot of confidence. You know, I knew I could get out there and do this stuff. And with the Arizona Trail, Beth Overton and I were the first people to through bike the Arizona Trail. And that's probably my favorite adventure that I did. It's something that I'll never forget. And it just to immerse myself in nature made the labor worth it.
Are there any hikes anywhere in the world that you like, I want to do that? I need to do that, but I haven't done it yet.
Oh yeah. The one in Switzerland and the Tour de Mont Blanc.
Okay.
I would like to do that. I've done the Milford Track in New Zealand. I'd love to do that again. Mm-hmm. Cause that is awesome. I've been told by the Australians that there's some great, they call them bushwalks. We call them through hikes. There's great bushwalks in Tasmania. So yeah, I would like to go there and maybe something in Patagonia in either Chile or Argentina.
Which is supposed to be just absolutely breathtaking.
Yes.
One last question for you. On your Instagram, at Haunted Hiker, which you need to be more active on, by the way. In 1993, is a photo of you with guns and drugs from a car stop. Just old guns. Do you remember that case, that job? Because you were young. You were kind of still a rookie, right? Or no?
Yeah. Maybe a semi-rookie. I think what's the great story about that is because when I got hired at Yosemite Valley in Yosemite National Park, you know, it had a raucous reputation. It's one of the busiest law enforcement districts in the National Park Service. And I was told time and time again that it was hard on women, that the guys were all sexist and stuff like that. So I got in there, you know, chip on my shoulder. I got to prove myself. So that was my first night when they let me loose to patrol on my own.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So I caught that dude, man, he had a lot of guns. I forget all the guns, but you see in the picture, there's a lot of ammo, a lot of guns, and you're not even supposed to be bringing those guns into a national park. And so I know I impressed the guys when I made that case, and you'll see there's a ranger, Jeff Totten, is in that photo with me, and he was definitely impressed. They started calling me the bulldog.
No, really?
Mm-hmm.
What made you initiate that car stop?
Lord, I wish I could remember, Mike. It was just probably some little thing, you know, but instinctual, you know, type of stuff. But I know he violated something. That was why I just pulled him over. But I don't remember those details.
Andrea Langford, this was a blast. I truly loved the book. I was once I got it, I couldn't put it down. I love the interview. I hope you come to New York because we can talk more about the things you did. We can talk more about the book over some beers. How's that sound?
That sounds wonderful. I can't wait.
Can you just plug your Instagram, Twitter, and the book because it comes out August 22nd, and I'll obviously release this as we get closer to that date, but just plug everything else.
Yeah, you know, my website, AndreaLangford.com, that you can link to my Twitter and my Facebook and my Instagram there. Another good site to follow, especially if you're interested in these cases or other missing hiker cases, is Missing from the Pacific Crest Trail on Facebook. There's a more activity there and items of interest to you if you're interested in that stuff.
Andrea, this was a blast. Thank you so much for doing this, and we'll chat soon, my friend.
Yeah, thank you too, Mike.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.